Hey, Steve, let's take a break from the podcast for a second to talk about 11 Reader, a brand new sponsor for us here on The Cinephiles. You're a big audiobooks guy. Talk to me about 11 Reader, bro.
I'm not just a big audiobook guy. I am an obsessive, compulsive audiobook guy. I always have headphones in my ears, and having 11 Reader gives me so many more options of things I can listen to. In addition to their 200,000 premium audiobooks, you can bring in your own material like PDFs, contracts you have to read, articles you might be using for research for maybe a podcast, perhaps. That's the way I like to listen to things. And I'll tell you something else, because listening is my preferred method of reading. I've even listened to some of my own work during the rewriting process, and that has been hugely helpful. And one of the best things about it is all the voices I get to choose from.
Yeah, that's the thing that sold me. You know, we've talked about audiobooks in the past. I dipped my toe in that arena, but haven't fully jumped in yet because sometimes I don't like the voices I hear narrating the books. But here on 11 Reader, I can choose from an incredible array of voices, well over 1,000 voices, including Michael Caine, Maya Angelou, Burt Reynolds of all people, and Laurence Olivier. So that's exciting for me that I can choose the voice I enjoy to hear to read a book back to me. Plus, the price point on this is amazing. $11 a month for the Ultra Plan, which includes 20 hours of flexible listening. And you can listen to these books in over 99 languages. That's an incredible selling point as well, Steve.
And if you're interested in trying out 11 Reader, you can download it from your app store and use our promo code podcast to get your first 2 months for only $1. That's 11 Reader with a promo code podcast to get your first 2 months for only $1. Hi, Cinephiles fans. This is Steve. Now, I was looking through my closet this morning where I have a shelf packed with old t-shirts that I only wear when all of my nice quince tops are in the wash. So rather than look like a slob near the end of the week, I decided this is the perfect time to donate those old tees and take another trip to quince.com for a wardrobe upgrade. Quince clothes are built to last and made out of premium materials, so I'll be able to wear them with pride for a long time. Now, I don't actually play golf, but that won't stop me from picking up another performance mesh golf polo. And I really like the look of the vintage wash tensile camp shirt, although I'm not sure I'll take it camping. So if, like me, you've got a closet filled with worn-out clothes, this is the perfect time to upgrade. They have premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60, with the kind of perfect fit, structure, and high-quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a go-to for everything from hotel-quality bedding and bath essentials to premium cookware, luggage, bags, and more. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/cinephiles. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/cinephiles.
Oh, broken-hearted Hoover fixer sucker guy. Oh, broken-hearted Hoover. Fixer sucker guy. One day I'll go there and win her once again, but until then I'm just a sucker of a guy.
Hello and welcome to Cinephiles One Takes, where we get to talk about films that we're excited about right now. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, and host and voiceover artist down here in San Diego, California. And, you know, at some point here, we're going to have to come out with like a new sound for the One Takes, like a little bit of an interesting new video or sound cue that introduces the One Takes. Could be a lot of fun to separate it from the Cinephiles as well. And speaking of sound, certainly this movie is going to be full of sounds that we talk about for sure.
I think that is a fantastic idea. I mean, this One Take thing is sort of new and we're kind of starting to figure out what it is. But one thing I can say is that it gives us a real opportunity to honor an incredible artist and musician that we sadly lost far too young. And that's the great Glenn Hansard, which is why today we're talking about Once.
Yeah, 2007's Once. I haven't seen it in a very long time, man. Always remember it being a film that was very moving at the time. And then doing research for a little bit of research for the film, just seeing how many top 10 lists of notable critics back then this film made. Like, it made the top 10 lists of so many notable film critics in 2007, and of course spawned a very famous Broadway show and won Oscars and stuff. And it's just a fascinating window into 2007, Steve. And a film like this, I don't know if it would even work nowadays or even be the cultural phenomenon that it was, but it certainly was amazing back then.
It's such a lovely film, and I hope that it would work. I hope that people would respond to it today, because it's just so sweet. And of course, we wouldn't be able to talk about this film without our incredible supporters on Apple Podcasts, as well as Patreon, where you're listening to this a week early, because these one takes will be released 1 week in advance before they show up in the regular podcast feed. And you also will be able to listen to our Cinephile Shorts, get ad-free versions of the show, and on Patreon, and also join our advisory board and ask questions for upcoming episodes.
And if you're listening to the show with ads, of course, if you hear a product or service that you want to try out, we'd really love it if you used our code, because A, you get a percentage of money off of that, and you signal to these companies to keep coming back and supporting us every month here on the Cinephiles. We have so many companies running with us right now. So yeah, please make sure you do that if you hear a product or service that you want to try.
John, do you remember how you first came to Once?
Yeah, I'm sure I remember seeing it in the theaters, probably seeing it with Michael or Shannon or Blue, or maybe even on a date. I might have even gone alone, but I remember this was a trailer that absolutely hooked me from the beginning, because, you know, at that time I was really into hunting out and exploring smaller films and uplifting smaller films by giving my money to it. And it had gotten good reviews. So I just remember that being a film that I went to see in the theater and just thoroughly fell in love with when I saw it back then.
This was the era of independent films. I mean, yeah. from Sex, Lies, and Videotapes and Reservoir Dogs all the way through 2009, when the DVD market collapsed and we had the financial crisis. And then I was foolish enough to put out my independent film the next year. but up until that point, this is what we were seeking out all the time. And for me, it was the same thing. I had heard about the film, saw it in the theaters, and was just totally brought into this world. I mean, just completely engrossed by it. And and perhaps even bigger, in fact, I can definitely say bigger, is the soundtrack. Yep. Because Karen and I got this soundtrack, and we listened. Karen and I spent a lot of time singing in the car together on road trips, which is a good thing, because Karen is actually on key. So if I'm singing with her, I'm much more likely to be on key than I am on my own. And we listened to this album over and over and over again. And I've seen Glenn Hansard in concert twice. And I think Karen maybe has seen him 5 or 6 times. That's how important this guy was to us in terms of, I mean, to me, honestly, I'll just say right at the beginning, he feels like just a pure artist. He just feels like a dude who just has to make art, you know?
Yeah, for better and for worse. Because, of course, he was a very tortured artist as well, with a lot of things that he was going through. And at this time, I mean, he didn't even want to do this movie. He didn't want to star in the movie. It wasn't his thing. He was going to write the music for the movie, and it was actually going to be Cillian Murphy who was going to be the star of this movie. And so he was kind of roped into it because him and John Logan, the director of this movie, had been in a band together. And so, and they were basing some of his experiences on the experiences of the movie and of some of John Logan's experiences with his girlfriend as well at the time. So there was a lot of like personal touches throughout the movie. So I'm glad Cillian Murphy did do this movie, because I think it wouldn't have had that, as you said, pure artistic feel that feels organic when you watch Glenn in the movie. When he is singing those songs, he is singing those songs. And when he's going through these awkward moments because he's dealing with the loss of someone that he cares about and not sure if he's going to go back to her or not, and kind of in that place of, am I going to pursue my dreams or not? There's real authenticity to the performance that he delivers here that doesn't feel actory, doesn't feel like it's trying to win an award. It just feels very natural and honest. And I think he's just so good in the film, in what he's doing, you know?
It's so crazy, because we've literally just spent more than a month on Cillian Murphy's, you know, tour de force Oscar-winning performance. I think he is an incredible actor. And man, I think it's a stroke of luck that he dropped out. This is Glenn Hansard's movie. I mean, it just is, you know?
Yeah. And he dropped out because apparently, from what I'd read, he didn't want to work with the young, the Markita Inglova, I think that's how you say her name. She was a new actress, and he just didn't feel comfortable necessarily jumping into this movie and working with her yet, you know? And for better or worse, everyone's got their reasons for doing stuff or not doing stuff. Maybe at the time in his career, he felt it wasn't a chance he could take. And like you said, a blessing in disguise, and that happens, you know?
Well, I also read that I think part of it too is that he heard Glenn Hansard singing the songs as Glenn is demoing them. Because apparently, like Killian, which I didn't realize, had been in rock bands, and like he was on the fork in the road of, am I going to try to be a musician or an actor at this time?
Right.
But I think, you know, if you hear Glenn Hansard sing Falling Slowly, you go, well, this is who's supposed to sing this song, you know?
Right. And even what's the song that they play twice with him as well? Something about She's Made Up Her Mind, or like that song is, I don't think Killian Murphy could have done justice to that song. Yeah. And that song is so powerful in this movie. You're so right to highlight the soundtrack because, it's been so long since I've seen the movie that to me, I just remember Falling Slowly. But watching the movie again for our discussion, there are so many good songs in this movie and on the soundtrack that made me go and download the soundtrack because I've never owned it. I've only owned Falling Slowly. I download the rest of the soundtrack to enjoy this music all over again, you know? So yeah, it's such a good, and again, it reminds me of Garden State, another independent movie had come out 3 years earlier in 2004, also an excellent soundtrack. Because for some of you may not have been into music at this time, like this, the kind of mid 2000s area here is where a lot of these more independent type of artists were coming through and dropping songs that were just one songs on soundtrack, but they stayed, like the Shins became massive off of Garden State. And so like there's all these things that happened for independent artists that are in the music scene paired with independent movies that really helped to blow up a lot of their particular fame, which I thought was great. And we were exposed to so much interesting music that wasn't in the pop culture main sphere, you know?
It's funny. I hadn't put it together until you just said it. Garden State is another soundtrack that Karen and I listened to over and over and over again. And it just occurred to me is like, so I'm not the biggest music guy. I know, everyone knows who listens to this. I listen to books and podcasts. I don't like sit and listen to music very much. When I did listen to music, I came up on the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel and Billy Joel and Bob Marley and all those people.
The greats.
Like I'm such, and grew up on folk music. And I'm such a singer-songwriter person, and it didn't occur to me until you just said it. That's part of why I respond to Once and the Garden State soundtrack, because they are really throwbacks to the folk singer-songwriter kind of world, which is what I grew up with.
Yeah, and I'm a massive fan of singer-songwriters, you know, all the way back to like fucking James Taylor and all the good ones, right? Good ones in the 70s, Dylan. And then you go through the 80s, and you like I remember finding like Sean Colvin. When I found Sean Colvin working at a random electronics store for about 3 months, they were playing Sean Colvin and I fell in love with her. And I've been a supporter of her for years. And that opened the door to all these singer-songwriters that I had not known about. You know, Carole King, all the way around backwards. I found her backwards after she'd already been established through Tapestry and other albums. So like, yeah, I love singer-songwriters. So I share that with you as well. Like the singer-songwriter stuff is amazing. And I still hunt it out on Sirius XM. They have Coffee Shop. And so I'm always seeing what's the new songs that I'll hear and listen to. Cause there's something about a great singer songwriter that if you're open to what they're singing to you and it connects with you, it can really move you in ways that other songs don't. Yeah.
So a little biography about Mr. Hansard. Of course, he was born in Dublin, not surprising, in 1970. There was a lot of music in his house. In fact, his mom shows up in this movie and sings, which is one of my favorite moments. He started busking on the streets in his teens. And the story goes that it sounds like he was just a complete disruption all through school. Like couldn't focus, couldn't pay attention, always making jokes. Really likable. Like it wasn't that he was a jerk. It wasn't that he was a bad kid. It was just that he wasn't learning anything and he was preventing everybody else from learning something. And apparently at 13 years old, his headmaster comes to him and says, "You're not doing anybody any good here, including yourself. So why don't you just play music on the street?" why don't you just start busking now? And basically he said, like, you might not become a rock star, but I'm confident if you do this, you can make a living. And so he did. He left school at 13 and became a professional musician playing on the streets.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's not something that maybe should be like, oh, wow, how amazing. It's like, what's it like to be 13 years old on the streets and what you experience at that 13 years old on the streets and what are those things that you come across? Yes, there's probably some really great moments and people really appreciate your work, but there's also weird people who walk the streets and, as we see in the movie, you know, stealing your money or, you know, dancing around while you're trying to sing your songs, acting the fool. And so how much of that did he have to deal with growing up? That was also an element of the some of the anger or some of the pain in his music. You know, it's fascinating.
And in 1991, of course, he appears in a movie that we've covered on the Cinephiles, which is he is in The Commitments. Yeah. And I never knew that was him. It was like I'd known The Commitments, and then I saw once, and it was maybe a year or two later that I found out that that was the same guy who's in The Commitments.
Yeah, I remember it being a big deal because, like, people had written articles on the sites that, like, this was a continuation of his character from The Commitments. But like you, when I saw the movie, I didn't remember that he'd been in The Commitments. And then when I read those articles, I was like, wait, what? That's the same guy? So yeah, there's like legends that have written, or legendary articles are written, like exploring whether this is the same guy from The Commitments just all these years later, which is a great little, you know, fantasy to explore.
And he forms this band called The Frames, and John Carney, who's the director, is the bass player of that band. That's where they come from. And somewhere in this time, right when they're doing their first album, he meets Marketa Iglova, who was 13 at the time when they met, and he was 32.
Oh, shit. Whoa.
Yeah.
All right.
And it sounds like he was embraced by her family. There's nothing going on between the two of them at this point. He gets invited back by Marquetta's family to stay at their house for 3 months just so he can write music.
Right.
Like, it sounds like her family really supported him. Mm-hmm. Now it comes time, we're getting towards 2007, and Carney wants to make this movie. And they had some budget put aside when Cillian Murphy was attached to do the movie because he had somewhat of a name. And when he dropped out, all the money dropped out. And it sounds like they basically, you know, unlike the United States, most countries actually have government money to support filmmaking. And so, you know, because they don't have massive film industries that are always turning a profit, so they're supporting local filmmakers. And about 75% of the budget came from the Irish Film Board.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
It sounds like what happened was they went from having a very small budget to making an independent film with Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
To losing a huge portion of that budget until they were only left with the money from the Irish Film Board and what they could scrape together. And that brought down the production values of this film quite a bit. This movie is largely shot guerrilla. It's a skeleton crew. It's shot over 17 days. And they shot this movie, which I don't know if people even know these terms these days, but they shot this movie on DV, which is digital video. It's not high definition. It is better than VHS. It is what I made Siren, the web series I did, was shot on DV. The fact that they made a feature film and blew it up to put on big screens that was shot on digital video at that low resolution is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And it never bothers me watching the film. I mean, I'm aware of it, but it doesn't bother me.
No, because I mean, I think we go into mindsets when it's independent film. We're not expecting 4K HD resolution at that time, right? Because this was not 2026 is not 2007, obviously, Stephen. Like the idea of 4K stuff was not really like this idea, right?
No, we were not there yet.
Yeah, SDHD was still somewhat new in the convergence and all of that. So there's a quaintness to having it be this kind of have this kind of look, which is reminiscent, obviously, of Blair Witch Project in 99. So when you go into an independent movie, I think there's a mindset that those of us who appreciate these kinds of films go like, well, you know, as long as I can make out what's happening, it doesn't have to be fully in HD. And in fact, I think because it's shot in DV, that adds a quaintness to it and an authenticity to it that is an element of why we enjoy the film. And from what I understand, like, these people in the crowd scenes didn't know they were being shot because they shot this film with long lenses. So you could see you could shoot these scenes and these people would be part of the film. And I don't know how you get away with that if you have to sign waivers or whatever, but like it was pretty interesting that, as you said, guerrilla style filmmaking to make a film like this.
It was the waivers thing that I was thinking about too, you know, because like and my guess is maybe they got waivers sometime. what you do, like I know what you're supposed to do, and I've done it a few times, which is like you're shooting what you shoot, and you see, okay, we got brown jacket, lady with a purple hat, and the guy and his kid all were in that last shot, and you send a PA running after them with a waiver and say, hey, we're shooting this movie. Do you mind signing this thing? You might appear in it. Right. And most people, by the way, sign it. Like they're very, you know, rarely do people go, because they're like, oh, I get to be in a movie. Okay. That sounds cool. Right. But most my guess cool is with this movie, they didn't even do that a lot of the time.
Yeah. Because I don't know what the rules are in Ireland. Do they have different rules for that kind of stuff? I don't know. Right. Yeah.
Hi, Cinephiles fans. This is Steve taking a moment to talk about our newest sponsor, Omaha Steaks. Now, everyone who listens to the show knows I love to cook. And frankly, there is nothing I cook better than steak. I've done au poivre, grilled, broiled, reverse sear, and even gone French style, basting the steak in the pan with butter, garlic, and thyme. But the truth is, a great steak isn't really about technique. It's about the simple pleasure of enjoying an amazing piece of meat. And if your meat sucks, well, so will your final product. That's why I was so happy to get Omaha Steaks as a sponsor on The Cinephiles. Since 1917, they've made it their mission to understand what makes a great steak. Now, personally, my favorite cut is a ribeye, but my 15-year-old is turned off by all that beautiful marbling. He prefers the far fancier filet, which means he's in luck because Omaha filets are rated USDA certified tender. Now, very few companies receive that rating because it's difficult, costly, and time-consuming, but that's the kind of quality you can depend upon with Omaha Steaks. Now, you might not know where your local grocery store sources its meat or how they prepare it, but you can be absolutely certain that the butchers at Omaha have not only hand-selected and carved your steak, but they also dry-age their meat, making it more tender and flavorful. Every steak is then vacuum-sealed and flash-frozen to lock in that perfect flavor. I'm also super excited about their ground beef, chicken, and on my next shipment, I'm definitely going to check out their seafood selection. So try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, we've been talking about BetterHelp for a long time on this podcast, but you don't have to take our word for it. If you want to hear how clients are responding, visit betterhelp.com/reviews. Now, it's basic statistics that the bigger the sample size, the more accurate the results. So with over 1.7 million reviews and hundreds more every day, that average rating of 4.9 out of 5 is serious evidence that you will be in very good hands. More than 6 million people worldwide have used BetterHelp, and the consistently positive feedback from real users is a sign of lasting quality. It's also easy to get started. Just answer a few questions, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, and switch therapists at any time if it's not the right fit. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, this is John. Well, summer is here, and it's time to take those special moments to kind of sit back and relax a little bit and enjoy the season. I'm talking about barbecues, pool days, road trips, heading out to the beach, heading out to the lake, going to the golf course, family gathering nights, or even late nights out in the backyard. And the best way to enjoy those nights is with a good cigar. Thompson Cigar can help you with that. They have been America's humidor since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at the lowest prices. They are a trusted source for cigar lovers seeking quality and value. With one of the largest humidors in America, Thompson guarantees fresh cigars shipped right to your door. And they offer a variety of unique five-pack fever deals, and value clubs offer unbeatable savings and curated experiences that keep customers just like you coming back for more. And I've already tried a couple of Thompson cigars, and they are so well made and solid. The outer leaf looks smooth and supple, and the taste of these cigars are like a meal. They have such complexity, and they burn slowly and evenly. This is an excellent cigar. Use our code CINEPHILES at checkout for up to 20% off your order of $75 or more. Or visit www.thompsoncigar.com/cinephiles. That's CINEPHILES. And the discount will automatically apply. Some exclusions apply.
Speaking of which, would you like to get into the film?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about it.
So, and of course, as we said, this is the Cinephiles one take. We are not going moment by moment, but we are going to kind of talk through it. And as you said, we start with that probably long lens shot where he's just busking and playing music in the street. And there's like an interaction with a dude who tries to steal from him. Yeah. And it all just feels very real, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, this was also the time, Steve, when we were getting exposed to Irish films and the Irish culture within these films, right? You know, there was The Van and, as you said, The Commitment. So all through the 90s and into the 2000s, there were these little gems, Circle of Friends, these Irish films that gave us a window into Irish culture. And this is, from what I understand, this is shot to look like when John Carney and Glenn were in the band. It's their version of Ireland, right? And so it's like, this is their version of Ireland, but it's not maybe the most authentic version of Ireland at the time. So we're seeing it through their prism. And so the idea of the interaction with the kid who's taking the money and their back and forth is kind of funny because it seems like he almost knows him, then gets the fiver off of him. But it's these things that we see a guy who's just trying to make a living doing what he's doing, dealing with outside forces, messing with what he's trying to do, which is funny.
So my feeling watching the movie at this point is like, okay, yeah, I mean, this is, okay, I'm watching a little independent film and this I'm intrigued enough. And then you cut to him alone in this alleyway, camera far away from him, and he's singing Say It to Me Now with nobody else around. And at that moment, and watching Glenn Hansard's just full-on fucking performance, giving it everything, I am now in this movie 100%.
This is the what people like to say, the refrigerator moment, right, Steve? Like, you're either in or you're out in this moment, and because he is giving his heart and soul to this performance. And it's not moving the narrative. It's not connected to, it's basically just giving you a window, an authentic window into this guy. And so you either like this guy and you like his music, or you don't, and this movie's not going to work for you. So I think it's a gutsy decision to do it this early, because there's no like, hey, will you play your favorite song? Or there's no lead up to the song. We're just being introduced to this guy and his abilities.
I think you're 100% right. You're either in or you're out. And the big thing is the music. If you're if you're going like, oh, I dig this singer, well, that you're going to get that the whole movie. And if you're at this point going, this is not my style of music, I turn it off right now, because there's just not, that's all, this is what the movie is. I honestly think, I don't know who has the most raw, emotional singing performances in popular music, but Glenn Hansard's in my top 10, 100%.
Oh,
like, it is full on. It's, you just feel his heart exploding out of him as he does this song.
100%. Yeah, it's great.
And like I said, I've seen him twice in concert. One of them was at the Greek Theater, which is a decent size. It's not like an arena, but a seat, probably several thousand people, 4,000 people. I don't know how big it is. And he's doing the concert and it's great. And then he goes, hey, I want to try something. And he walks away from the microphone. Ooh. He walks downstage center. And he starts playing Say It to Me Now, this song that he plays in that alleyway. And he played it without any amplification whatsoever.
Wow.
And it was one of the most, and it's quite, you know, and I'm like, I didn't have great seats. I didn't have terror. I didn't have nosebleeds. I'm 30, 40 rows away from him in this really big space. And it was, everything you see in the movie is what he's doing. It's just, I am going beyond maxing out my vocal power and emotional power in order to sell this moment. And it's one of the greatest moments I've ever had in a concert, to be honest.
I'm sure. Tony Bennett was legendary for doing this, where he would take one song and not sing on the microphone and would stand in front of the audience and sing. because his voice could carry to the back of the auditorium. Obviously, dude, I saw him twice at the Hollywood Bowl. He can't do that at the Hollywood Bowl, really. But in the more intimate, like in the MTV Unplugged with Bennett, there's one moment where he just, no microphone, he just sings straight up. And that's amazing. It's always, that shows you the talent of a singer, if they can do it without the amplification, without the microphone. So that must have been an amazing experience to see Glenn do that in person. You know.
And right at the end of this, there's Marquetta.
Yeah.
And there's something, the connection that they have in this movie is so odd and so real and so palpable and mysterious. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like as soon as they're together on the screen, you're in.
I don't know if it's an Eastern European thing. I don't know if it's a translation thing, but she's so like she doesn't put up with bullshit. Like from the beginning, she's asking these questions. She's not caught up with like social norms, what's right to ask, what's not right to ask. She's just in on essentially asking him all these questions to get information. And, you know, we immediately go, okay, what's she trying to find out here? But she's literally legitimately just asking the questions because she wants to get the answers. So yeah, it's a fascinating approach to this character. And she's also as authentic as hell. I think she was, what, 19 when she made this movie or 16? I don't know how she was. She was like,
I think she's 18.
18, yeah, 18, when she makes the move. But she's got this kind of like sweet energy to her. And then, as I said, the asking the questions, kind of burrowing through to get to the answers, which unsettle him, which I think is great.
She has a self-contained quality and a confidence, which really, in my opinion, belies everything we know about her circumstance. Like she's in this weird country with this marriage that's kind of in trouble. Money is obviously really a problem. And yet she just seems to know who she is. You know?
Yeah, very much so. Which I think is important about the movie. You know, the idea of sometimes you meet people in your life at a certain time. They may not be with you for the rest of your life, but they change you. And yes, maybe there are romantic feelings and maybe they don't get pursued and they'll never get pursued. And we'll see by that end moment if we believe it or not. But like, we don't know if they'll ever get pursued, but like, it changes you, but they come at the right time. And if you're an artist, I think there's a universal energy that attracts that energy to you at the right time for you to do the things that you need to do. And I think that was great about watching their connection here. And as the movie progresses, what she's experiencing, what she's going through, and then what he's going through, they help each other through this time. And every time he wants to take it in a certain direction, she's very clear that it's not that direction that they need to go in. And as you said, because she's very sure of herself and she knows what's right and what's wrong to her.
I think you really put your finger on something really important, because these are both artists. And even though she might never work as an artist really in her lifetime, and I think she knows, but art recognizes art, and she has recognized him. He hasn't recognized her yet, but he will. And she sees that thing in him. And I'll just say, this is among my favorite movies about the creation of art that I, it's funny, you know, we just did Whiplash recently, which is also theoretically about an artist's journey to become a great artist.
Yeah.
I find almost nothing in that movie that represents my experiences of art. You know what I mean? But everything I see in this movie is like, seems totally real, you know?
But you never had a mentor fuck you over? I feel like that has happened.
You know, that's, you know, 100% true. But you know what? Actually, you're right. You're right. I should take it all back. Obviously. But it isn't, but that's not how I want to make art, I suppose. Well,
this is, you know, what I want to get. Yeah, I think the film is a fairy tale about being an artist. It's a fairy tale because they never struggle. They never go through some really tough things. He never makes like the move too far, you know, physically with her. Like, this is a nice fairy tale. His dad's very supportive. You know, his friends are willing to leave the street and go do an album. The crotchety producer gets won over. So it's very fair. Even the girl who's left to go to London receives him with open arms on the phone. So it's very fairy tale-ish, which is what makes the film so magical, you know, because you want it to be like this. Because great art is rarely like this. Created rarely.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And it just occurred to me, and maybe I should have occurred to me a long time ago, but the title is Once, like Once Upon a Time.
Yeah,
exactly. Once Upon a Time. So it is a fairy. This is this magical moment in time that, you know, whether it happened or didn't happen, it's like, and I think we know watching this movie this magical moment in time that happens once is never going to happen again.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like your read on it because I read an interview with John Carney. He said, I called it once because it's in honor of all the artists who say that once I do this, then I'll pursue my artistry. Once this happens, I'll be able to become an artist. So it's all these great artists who never followed their dreams because they kept waiting for that once thing to happen before they pursued it. When the truth is, you have to pursue it, whether that once thing happens or not, if you really want to, you know, achieve it. But I like the Once Upon a Time reference so much. So maybe it's working on multiple levels, this title, which is great.
I mean, it never occurred to me until you were just talking about it as a fairy tale, but it feels like it fits in how I feel about the movie. Mm. And we have another him just, you know, I love listening to Glenn Hansard. So he's, you know, sitting alone on his bed playing You've Broken Me All the Way Down.
Oh,
I mean, beautiful song.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I referenced the ex. Like, there are elements of what he's going through in this movie that I went through, you know, making that call and then not being able to leave the message, sitting there listening to songs about heartbreak because you're so caught up in the pain of all of it. Even if you kind of secretly know inside of yourself it wasn't the right person for you, you still fell in love with that person. And the wreck of that kind of just comes at you at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're by yourself sitting in your bedroom or on your couch. So, you know, I remember being this young and having these things be so important, bro. Like, that was so amazing about watching the film again. It's like, I don't even recognize that guy from back then, but I remember being that guy from back then, you know, and there's elements of that in Hansard's performance throughout.
Because he is stuck as a human. Yeah. And if Marquetta has not come along, he would have stayed stuck.
He would have never, I don't think he would have ever found his way to do this. Yeah, agreed.
Yep. And that, you know, of course he works in a vacuum repair shop because that's his dad's business. And so, and Marquetta has found out about it. So she just shows up to where he's busking with the vacuum cleaner and all the shots of them walking with her, dragging the vacuum cleaner behind are fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, like you just said, like once, like I just said, it was a fairy tale as well. Like she's essentially wearing her fairy tale dress. She's essentially a princess. Right. And her bringing that behind her makes her unique, but at the same time, no different than anyone else who's bustling around doing weird shit in what I imagine is downtown Dublin. And so it's like, it's a fascinating approach that they take with the movie. And her dragging that thing around is just so matter-of-factly, like it's not a big deal, I think is great.
And it ends up that in addition to, I think, selling magazines and selling flowers, she also occasionally works in a music shop because she needs to get every penny she can. She's got a kid and she's got a life she has to support. And he follows her to this music shop and there's a piano. And I guess she's essentially hired to play the piano every once in a while during lunch break or something. Mm. And so they go to sit down to play a piano and he watches her play. Mm. And you can see that he's moved. You can see that he goes, oh, this is an artist, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
recognizes that in her.
I think that's where, like, he starts to fall for her, is seeing her artistry through her playing. And I'm not a musician, you know, you say you're not a musician. So, like, I wonder if musicians who listen to us or watch this movie have had this experience where they immediately start to fall for someone because of how they play. Because of how they sing, because of the music they create. You know, there's an element of that I think that is really fascinating to explore with musicians.
I'll tell you a weird story, which is, you know, I pursued Karen for a really long time and then we started dating and she had always talked about singing and I knew that she had been in all the high school musicals and had played the lead in many of them.
Right.
But we didn't go and do karaoke or anything. And I sang with her in the car. You know, so like I've heard, it's not that I had never heard her sing. I had heard her sing a lot, but we went to her high school reunion. It might've been her 10 year or might've even been her 5 year high school reunion. And we get to her high school and she went to this really small private high school. And so it's, you know, like she had a graduating class of like 50 people or something like that. So we get there and everyone ran up to her and said, Karen, are you going to sing? And then they said, Karen, we set up karaoke. When are you going to sing? And this happened over and over again. And I was like, this is weird. It was weird. I mean, I knew she had sung in high school, but they were treating her like a star. And then she went, and then they went to the karaoke and Karen got up and sang. I had never heard her sing. in that way. And you've obviously done karaoke with Karen a lot. Yeah, Karen has a great voice. Yeah. She's a great voice. And what's interesting about it is that I think the human being that sings at a microphone is an entirely different person from the person who I had known, even though we had been dating, because she has a confidence singing that she doesn't actually have the rest of the time, you know? And so that idea of falling in love with someone's, the artist inside them is something I 100% get.
Yeah. I mean, actors do it, right? Once you see someone in class do a scene, you're like, holy shit, he or she or they can really hit those beats, and you're like blown away. And all of a sudden you have a whole nother feeling about them, you know, that could lead to you getting romantic feelings for them. So yeah, it's absolute art is so, so when people try to step on art or kill art or remove funding for art, you're killing the soul of humanity. The soul of us is not building a massive corporation and creating TikTok. That's not the soul of us. But what they do with that TikTok, the artistry that can be on TikTok or Vine or X, or like when you're creating stuff or on YouTube, like that's art, right? And so it's like those things you gotta keep in the spirits alive. These people who try to kill art, man, I think there's something broken in their souls, because art is so important. And guess what? That Al Pacino line you quote, that Robert De Niro line you quote, that's fucking art, you know? And so it's like those things, I think people have this disconnect sometimes between how essential art is to our lives and art itself, which is just mind blowing.
And I think because she played so well and because he felt a connection, he feels safe enough to pull out what he knows is his best song and share it with her. And I love the sort of him teaching her what the changes are and teaching her the tempo and kind of hinting at some things. It feels very real and very natural. And then when they start playing Falling Slowly, it is an absolutely magical moment on film.
Yeah, loved it. Absolutely loved it. It's so amazing to watch them come together. And, you know, they're coming together as a possible relationship too, friendship. And then, of course, eventually possibly more before it's snuffed out. But like, you see the beginning. And we're in now as the audience. We're like, oh, we want this to happen now, which is great.
And first you see like she's tentative and then she starts to get the hang of it, and you see them and she keeps looking to him and he keeps looking to her, and you can see the sort of facial expressions and head tilts that say, okay, now we're going to do this change. Okay. Now we're going back to the chorus or whatever it is. And then you see the confidence hit for her and him start to realize, because I think he started with like, I want to share this song with you and, you know, maybe you could play along. And then halfway through, he starts to go, oh no, this is, something is happening. Something special is happening. Yeah. And then she feels it too. And then you could feel like where the song starts to become her own, that she starts to play it and sing it as if it's, as if she sung it 1,000 times. I mean, and this is, you know, like in general in musicals, you would pre-record the music and then you would lip sync to what you pre-recorded. That is not once, you know, possibly the exception of where she's singing by herself while listening to the, when she's coming up with the lyrics. I think that's pre-recorded, but I think everything else is no, this is just how they sang it on the day. And it's astounding.
And by the way, this is acting, right? Yeah. I mean, this is acting as well. Like people, you can get so caught up in this, because especially if you come into the film knowing that they're a couple in real, or they were a couple in real life while they were making the movie. Like there is this sense of like, oh, well, of course. But when you're watching this scene, this is acting, and they're playing the innocent moments. They're playing the build of the connection. And then, as you said, then they're in simpatico with confidence, both sharing back and forth their performances within the song, which is great. And we're on board now by the time they're done the song.
Totally. And now they're riding in the bus, still on the journey to get this vacuum cleaner fixed. And she starts asking him about himself. And what the way I interpret this is that he's actually not capable of expressing himself in words with talking.
Oh, right.
He's only capable of telling his story through song. So he sings the song, you know, broken-hearted Hoover fixing sucker guy, which is hilarious and is on the soundtrack.
And apparently was an improv. Like yeah. it was not, they weren't supposed, he wasn't supposed to, but he did that as an improv and it, and they kept it. John Carney kept it.
They get back to his place. We're getting the vacuum cleaners going to get fixed. They're up in his room. And now I think we're really going, what is this? Like what's,
yeah.
Because a woman goes up to a room with a man she just met. I mean, we can be pretty clear about what the man is thinking about, you know?
Right. Right. Cause he invites her up and she's like, sure. That's like, it's not a second. Cause she's not thinking what he's thinking. She's just like, sure. I found a new person, a new friend. Let's talk. Yeah. Let's hang out, you know? But of course for him, cause he's broken and he's lonely and he's a little bit, he's seeking connection. And he's just shared his song with her.
Yeah.
There he's thinking maybe there's something more to what's going on.
And so he says, stay the night. Yeah. She is taken aback. And this is that self-contained, practical, in charge of her own life thing. She just says, fuck this. Thanks for the Hoover. See you around. And walks out.
I love that. It's not, because it's not delivered in a way of like, how can I say this? It's not a way to take him down or destroy him. She's just speaks her mind. She speaks her truth. That's her honesty. And because it's her second language, maybe she doesn't understand the usage of certain terms in certain moments, because fuck this could be taken in a really brutal way. But for her, the way she's delivering it, it's much more like, no, this is this. Fuck this. I'm getting out of here. It's not for me, you know, and I'm walking out and no questions asked. And there's nothing he could have done to stop her. And he just kind of sits there feeling stupid. And haven't we all been there when we've said the wrong thing to a girl or a guy you're interested in or a person you're interested in? And you cross that line and you misread that there was attraction or intention and there wasn't, at least in the time he misread it, possibly.
I think she has just real insight into humans. I think she's able to size up people, not just Glenn, but all sorts of people really, really quickly. And I think she is 100% knows that this guy is a talented musician. That's 100%. Yeah, yeah. And she 100% knows what her talents are.
Yeah.
And she knows when they played together that some magic happened. And that's why she went with him to this place. And that's why she went up in the room.
Right.
It's because of their musical connection. Yeah. And she is aware that she is an attractive woman and that he might be attracted to her. But that's not why she's here.
Right.
She didn't come here for that. So when he makes that move, she goes, no, fuck this. I'm out of here. You know?
Exactly.
But then he finds her again on the street and there's no hard feelings. There's no like... Yeah. And she invites him back to her place. And again, everything is so real. This is all shot in their friends' apartments and in places that they know and on streets that they know in Gorilla. And it feels that way. And the camera is not in the perfect Spielbergian spot. And the cinematography is not gorgeous. But you feel like you are in the real world, in their world.
Yeah, I like that he apologizes to her and it's honest, right? And he's got it. He's got the stuff for her. I think he gives her the CD player so she can listen. Like, he's just very like, okay, I'm sorry, all this kind of, like, please. And so she accepts him because he's being honest, just like his music. She accepted him when she, like, started to connect with him because of the honesty in his music. She finds the honesty in his apology. So then she shares her world with him just like he shared the song with her. When we go into this and into her place and her mom there and their child there. And then when those three guys come in to watch TV, like, to me, as the son of immigrants, this is something that I remember experiencing where we lived in Falls Church. You know, other Latino families would come in and watch stuff with us, or we'd go to there because they got the color TV. We didn't have a color TV until I moved to Southern Virginia there. So, like, going to someone else's house who had enough money to afford a color TV, it was a great experience, you know? So those things were like, there's elements of this that I had forgotten about when I watched the movie again that really touched on the immigrant experience I had with my family here. Yeah.
And just as he shared Falling Slowly with her in the music shop, now he shares a track that doesn't have any lyrics.
Mm.
And then we see her, through frustrating things with her family, have to go down to the battery's dead and she has to go down to the store.
Yeah.
And she's listening to his track. And then we hear the lyrics that she comes up with. And it's the only non-Glenn Hansard track, and nothing to me compares to his voice, but it is a lovely song.
It is. It is, you know, and the fact that he is like, he suggests that she write the lyrics and she's, you know, she's moved by it. She's overwhelmed by it. She's honored by it that he would ask her to write the lyrics. So she's like full on committed to finding lyrics for it. And it's her way of expressing herself, right? Because she probably hasn't been able to express herself artistically except for that hour she gets to play the piano every once in a while in that shop. So it excites her, you know, and so she's willing to do all of these things to be able to keep writing the lyrics, which is great, you know, which is also a, I think, an expression of love that you would take someone's music and then you would work really hard to write the best lyrics you can because you know that it's important to them, you know.
It's expression of love both ways because it's also, I'm going to share this personal, I'm going to let you take over this thing that I made and make it yours as well. And of course, by the way, Marquetta did not actually write this song. Glenn Hansard wrote the song, but in the movie, she writes the song.
Yeah.
Back with him. I just love all the songs in on the album and it's him singing Lies as we see flashbacks of his relationship and 100% works, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just him sitting on I think he's sitting on his bed when he's singing some of this is just, it's raw and powerful and all these images that are romantic are feeling so painful as we hear all the pain in the song.
Yeah. And the actress who's playing the ex-girlfriend, Marcella Plunkett, I think she was with either John or Glenn. And so they used elements of this relationship. So those videos were not shot for the movie. They were shot. They had already been shot from the relationship, I think, with John or Glenn. And so they used those videos in the movie. She gave them permission to do so. And she's been in every John Carney movie since, Flora and Son, Sing Street. She's Eamon's mom in Sing Street. And then recently in, what's the most recent one that came out? I forget. Power Ballad.
Oh, right.
She's in that as well. So, yeah.
And then he makes the decision that he's going to go to London and that he wants to record a demo and he wants her to play on it. Yeah. Which is going to be the second half of the film. And we, I love that we go to negotiate with the studio and he is totally incompetent. And then she takes over and makes the deal.
You need someone like that. You need someone like that.
I certainly do. I could really use that. And you know, she buys him nicer clothes. They go to the bank and to find out the dude's a musician. So they get some money from a loan from him.
I love him in the suit shop and he comes out and this is perfect Irish humor where he turns to the guy and goes, how do I look? You look gorgeous. And so just like totally taking the piss out of him. I love that Irish humor for that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you're right. When you get to that agent and he's like, oh yeah, I'll do it because let me show you that I was once a busker too. And I ended up taking a job working in this bank and I could never see my dreams come true of possibly becoming an artist. So I think there's a lot of frustrated artists working in jobs that they never wanted to work in. And so when someone comes along who maybe who asks for your help, you're willing to do something because you didn't do it, you know? And I think that matters.
Well, and to your point, I mean, this really is a fairy tale. Like you get no bank is going to give anybody a loan to make a record demo. I mean, that's completely ridiculous.
What's your collateral? Exactly. Yeah. Oh, your song is great. Here's $200.
Sounds like a great investment. A record. I mean, that's just not a good investment.
But I like that she takes the lead, right? That's important. She's taking the lead, as you said, Steve, so well, in the negotiations with the studio and gets him out of 2000. She goes, we no longer talk, we shake. It's great. And then she's picking the clothes out for him and she talks about how that's where she got the big suit jacket, same location. And then, you know, negotiating what she negotiates with the guy to the money. She says, I'm of the belief that it will work out for him, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, she's driving this train. But without her, there's no way he would have been doing any of this. He might still just be busking in the streets, hanging out with his dad, and then eventually having to take over the vacuum repair business, you know?
Well, and it's also, I mean, you know, this is an immigrant story. Yes. And I look at this woman and go, man, how much would she be capable if she weren't just struggling to keep her, you know, her head above water? This woman could do so many things. She is so competent. Much more competent than Glenn Hansard's character, who is a great musician. And then we go back and then we go to this party, which, by the way, this is Glenn Hansard's flat. This is where he lives, is where they shot this. Yeah. And the first person, and it's just, you could feel that, oh, with this family and friends, music is a constant. And we start yes. with Glenn Hansard's mom singing, and she has a great voice. And I love Irish folk music. So I'm totally sold on this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so, I love the scene, the camaraderie, the artistry yep. that's in that, right? Artists always are drawn to other artists in communities. Yeah.
And the song is gold, and it's really tough. I mean, Falling Slowly is the you know, the 200-pound gorilla oh, yeah. on this album. But picking the next two or three songs is very hard for me, and Gold yeah. is certainly one that I love.
Yeah.
And my feeling, because now they've spent some time together, is that you see her continuing to watch him mm-hmm. and seeing the beauty in him, and you see him continuing to watch her and yeah. see the beauty in her.
Because being around him is helping her grow. As much as, yes, she knows what she wants, she's still struggling with the idea of the husband and the child. And, like, you know, she's selling roses. Like, there's things she's having to do as an immigrant in this country in order to pay her bills, right? Well, I think this is amazing to have this talk about this film right now with this character because of, you know, there's all this idea of immigrants are bad, immigrants are bad. You know, most immigrants are just a majority of immigrants, a large majority of immigrants are just trying to find a way to make some money and exist. And they're willing to do some of the shittiest jobs, some of the toughest jobs, living on pennies a fucking day in a place full of other people who are trying to live there as well and be able to do what they can to pay the rent just so they can not live in a terrible situation that they were living in before. And so I like that there's a sweetness to her story and what she's doing. And she's not like downtrodden. Oh, it sucks to be an immigrant or anything. She's happy, joyful in what she's doing and what she's pursuing. But where she's stuck in is her husband. Where she's stuck in is her child. What am I going to do? How am I going to provide? How do I express myself artistically? Because I can't afford a piano. I don't have the money for a piano, which she says early in the film, but I love playing. So, you know, we see that he, in essence, is helping her satisfy that creative thing that she's been missing in her life, and which I think is great.
I have a way of framing it sort of popped into my mind, and let's see if I could articulate it, which is that she's very practical.
Yes.
She might, and I think she knows what she wants. She knows she wants to make music and do all those things, and mm-hmm. she looks at the world that she's in, and she goes, well, that's not reasonable. There is no way, this doesn't exist, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that mm-hmm. she cuts herself off to some degree from going down that road too far yeah. because she knows that's not practical.
Yeah.
Glenn Hansard's character is totally impractical.
Yeah.
He is a dreamer, but he has no idea how to get to where he wants to get to
right.
and no
right.
idea how to take the first step. And so yeah. He needs her practicality, and she needs him to take her on the artistic journey that she hasn't been able to get, exactly. you know?
Yeah.
And, but she also knows that her journey has to be a short one, you know?
Mm.
And now, okay, we're going to make this album. We've pulled some other buskers off the street. We're rehearsing like in his little apartment. And it's you're totally right. This is why it's a fantasy. Dad's bringing them tea, you know.
That's great. I love it.
He's,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. he's not saying, when are you going to get a real job? I got vacuums that need cleaning, you know, fixing.
It's it has La Bamba bones, right? Because his mom was so supportive of Richie taking over the control of the band.
Yeah.
You know, there's little things like that. And the mom almost has a little bit of the Marquita energy in the movie, in her negotiating the deal with Joey Pants, her negotiating the deals for Richie. So there's, you know, there's, you got to have that strong energy. And I would say most of the time, strong female energy, because most dudes are out there with stuff, and there are always holes in our things we can handle. And it's good to have a female energy to kind of be practical about stuff, because a lot of times women have to be practical in this world, unfortunately, in order to survive. And so it's ingrained in them. And so seeing what she's does here throughout, I think is so great.
It's time to start our recording session. And as you mentioned before, the producer is not into this at all.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I get
yeah.
it. Like, I'm sure if you run in like this little studio, you'll get some yeah. rich kid who wants to record their album and know people totally tone deaf and awful songs. And that is what he listens to most. And the thing is, he's an artist too. He wanted yeah. to be made. He wanted to be George Martin. He didn't want to be here doing this shit. And
right,
so
right.
he's totally dismissive of these people. And then they go into the first song, and it's just, I love it. It's perfectly done. He's paying no attention whatsoever. They start singing, and then he kind of looks up a little bit, and he adjusts, You know, it's like, oh, well, maybe this is okay. I adjust a slider. And then by the end of the song, and particularly because Glenn Hansard is just 100% goes for what he goes for. By the end, this producer is in.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is great because he was on the phone, you know, and he was even telling them to wait before they started, which is really rude. And they're reading. And so that's a great, when you can win someone over because you're that good, I think it shows a signal to everybody that, you know, this guy you need to pay attention. And I love that about the scene. And when when he gets on board, dude, he is fully on board.
No,
you know,
he's in. He's the George Martin thing. He's the fifth Beatle, you know, it's so funny. Like I think I've said on the show that for whatever reason, in my mid to late 50s, I've become a much more emotional person. And I find tears right there a lot more often. And the thing that gets me the most is art. I mean, it's in particular artists making art. And I don't mean that I can watch a beautifully constructive comedy bit and it makes me cry, which sounds totally bizarre, but it's the construction. It's all and that's what you're seeing. This is such a great scene for art because it is putting all of your emotions into it. It's the attention to detail. It's the not quitting until you get it right. It's all of those and watching these people do it and making something emotional, it just moves the shit out of me. It really does.
Like Salieri, right? When he sees Mozart's pieces, when he that scene, when he grabs it and he's like, replace one note and there would be diminishment. You know, it's all so perfect. And he just drops the score from his hands in tears because of how beautiful it is. Because, you know, art loves to recognize art, you know? And so there's some emotion with that. Yeah, of course.
The next song is probably my least favorite. It's the one on the synth keyboard. It's still good. It's a good song, but and this is the thing about the movie. I think my editor brain feels there is at least one and maybe two too many songs. Like I feel like it drags a little bit. I love the movie. I love it all. I'm not saying that I would change it. But my gut is there's maybe one or two too many songs.
Okay.
And now once that producer signed on, he is good to go. Cause now it's 4 a.m. I don't know if he's getting paid anymore. I don't know, but he's like, no, we're going to get this right. And
right. They work through the weekend, which you can do when you're young, Steve, no sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we have her play his song that she wrote the lyrics for on the piano. And the thing about it is like suddenly those lyrics really are about them and about her life and her husband. And it just really hits emotionally, I think.
She breaks for the first time in the movie. Yeah. You know, like you said, we'd seen her be pretty self-composed, knows who she is. But here in this, you know, forbidden room, she's not supposed to be there. She sits down at this piano. Glenn follows her in during this break. And they have this beautiful moment where it's the reverse of the falling slowly moment, where she's now sharing right with him. And so you see what comes through. And I think he develops a whole nother appreciation for who she is and moves past his loneliness and develops a very deep affection for her as a human being, regardless of the romantic feelings. Right. And I think that's what's great about that moment and her breaking down like she does, you know, there's more to her. The vulnerability is really important. And, you know, it's how we connect with people. It isn't, oh, they're so cool. They're so cool. They're always right. It's those moments where you see their humanity come through. That's what makes you care about people. Always.
I think he has found so many things in her. So the romantic thing and the sexual attraction is clearly there.
Sure.
But I actually think it's probably the least of the things that are happening. The artistic connection,
I think it does recede. I think you're right. Yeah.
Well, it's there, and there's no question in my mind that had she not been so strong and said no, that they would end up in a relationship, which of course Glenn and Marquetta actually did. But
right.
But to me, it's he's got to go. I was busking alone in an alleyway 5 days ago. You know, and that now this person, I've actually recorded most of an album. I've got plans to head to London. I got a new suit. So there's all this practical stuff. My art is better than it has ever been with her influence. I think in this moment, he's got, like, she's magic. She is magic for my life, not just romantically, but like, I need this. I need to keep this person around. I was nowhere and now I'm somewhere, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And he says to, he asked her to come to London. And again, she just, the you know, she kind of jokes her way out of it and is obviously not biting. I love, by the way, that after this, they finished the album and now the producer says, we got to do the car test, which you 100% do. I have done the car test many times because you need to hear it on different kinds of speakers.
And yeah, they all
pile in the car. And now we're listening to all the songs we already heard them record, which is, this is where I'm kind of going, okay. Because they, one of the other things that they wanted to do, essentially every song is the whole song. He didn't want to do, and this is where you just like snippets. Most movies you go like, well, I do a verse and a chorus, but I wouldn't necessarily do another 3.5-4 minute song, you know?
Right.
And then, you know, they're all kind of breaking up and he's talking to her. And I love this exchange because he's trying, you know, she needs to go back to be with her family and her husband.
Yeah.
And he wants her to hang out. And she says, for what? We just hanky panky. And he says, it won't be hanky panky. And she says, I know it would. Which means she's just, again, she's practical. She's like, no, if I go out with you now, we will have sex.
Yeah.
Which is saying, and he's kind of like, really? You know, because that is confirmation of the attraction.
Right. And there's a scene earlier, which we didn't touch on, but the motorcycle scene is
a really
important scene because like he steals the motorcycle. They go, it's from her dad, from his dad. They go on this motorcycle, they connect and they talk about her husband. They talk about, and he's like surprised that she's married because he knew she had a kid. And so that they have that conversation. But when she says, why don't you love him? She responds in Czech, which people said later on, because it wasn't subtitled, because I love you. So she does have feelings for him. She does have affection for him. So we don't know that though, because that's not translated, right? It's not till this moment. You know, if you know Czech, you knew that already, but most people didn't. And so when you get to this moment where she says hanky panky and she says, I know there would, she's essentially saying, if I go with you, I know what I'm going to do. Because I'm very self-possessed and I know it's going to happen. And I know you won't be able to resist doing it. So I know what's going to happen. So I have to stop us. Because she says, I think there's a line she says, it wouldn't mean, like it would go
she
nowhere.
She says, I have it. She says, and that would be nice, but it would be worthless.
It would be worthless, right. Because she can't pursue it because she's still married.
Yep.
And she knows he's still hung up on his ex-girlfriend because she says that to him earlier in the film. You're not over her. No one writes a song like this who's over the person that they've written about, you know? So she knows they can't do it. And he wants this magical moment because in his mind, this is the consummation of everything they've been going through. But she has to put the kibosh on, which I think is very strong of her because she knows where it could lead and the damage that it could cause. So she has to be stronger than her desires, which is not easy to do in life.
I am assuming you have seen Witness with Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis.
Yeah, of course.
Another movie I would totally do is a Cinephiles One Take, by the way.
Sure.
The thing that I that always struck me about that movie is there's obviously this huge attraction between the two of them. And yet, you know, watching that film, that there is no way for that relationship to happen. And you know that both of them know that there is no way for that relationship to happen. This isn't exactly the same thing. I think it's exactly the same thing for her. She's just like, yes, I'm attracted to you. Yes, I'm into you. Yes, there is some fantasy in which we could have this thing, but I can't do that. And so there's no, it's, so it'd be worthless, you know?
Right.
And now,
let me say this real quick, Steve. And for the men who are listening to us right now, sometimes you have to listen to women in those moments. You may want to push farther. You may think you know better. Sometimes you do have to listen to a woman in those moments because she sometimes does know better and she does know where it's going to lead. And you sometimes don't. And so I think this is important to highlight in this moment because sometimes women are the smartest people in the room. Sometimes a woman is the smartest person in a relationship in certain moments or in the beginning of a relationship or stopping something from going forward because it could be damaging. And so, you know, I think it's important to highlight that in this moment.
Well, John, I'll have you know that I've listened to every single woman who didn't find me remotely attracted or didn't want to pursue a relationship with. So I feel like I'm ahead of the game.
That's not what's happening here, though. She's attracted. She's attracted.
Oh, yeah. Right.
She just has a husband, for God's sake.
If I ever have the opportunity to have a woman attracted to me who doesn't actually want to pursue something, I promise you I will listen to her.
Please do. Everybody, please listen.
And now, just to continue the fact that this is a fantasy, he gets to have Dad listen to his thing and say it's brilliant.
Now, you talk about, well, you just said a few minutes ago, like, for some reason, I'm getting more emotional. That happens, bro. Every man gets older and the walls come down and you start to be more, you know, emotional. And my dad was never more emotional than he was the last 10 years of his life, because he'd been such a rock hard guy for the majority of his life in terms of his feelings. And it happens. And this moment got me. Bro, I was watching this on a Sunday morning. I was sitting there on the couch at 8:30 in the morning just crying during this scene, because I miss my dad and I miss sharing things with my dad. And this scene brought that all back to me. Again, I hadn't seen this film in a long time, didn't remember this scene at all. And just the honesty from this actor playing his father, when there's this gap after he finishes listening to it, and you're wondering, and of course his natural artistic insecurities kick in. He's like, did you not like it? It's not good. What's wrong with it? And then his dad blurts out how much he fucking loved it. And it's like, oh my God, that's all you ever want from someone who you love and respect. When you become an artist, that approval from your parents is massive. At least it is for kids of my age. I don't know, or people my age, I don't know if the new generation gives a shit as much, but I know for people who grew up at my age, getting that approval from your parents is like massive, dude. Massive.
Yeah, I never had this scene with my dad. And my dad did not. I have become much more emotional. My dad was a rock until the day he died. He did not crack. And then he calls the old girlfriend, and she's happy that he's coming to London and says she misses him.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make me happy, because I don't like her. I mean, I like Marquetta. I don't like this woman dumped him and moved away. I don't feel good about that at all.
A fantasy, right? Yeah. A fairy tale. She's willing. I can't wait till you come here. I'm glad you're coming here. Blah blah blah. So yeah.
And as we're leaving on the trip and Falling Slowly is playing again, a piano gets delivered to Marquetta as a going away gift. And it's just, again, this very much in the world of this life. Yeah. As he's heading off to London.
Yeah. She doesn't come to the door. She tells her mom she's not there. Maybe she is there. Maybe she isn't. He can't find her, but he wants to thank her. And so he takes this money and delivers the piano to her. And she's so overjoyed to get the piano, and they put it in there. And, you know, as he's flying into London and running through the airport to go see his girl, we see her playing the piano. Right. And there in her room where she lives with her child, her husband is there. Her mom is there. The guys who watch the TV are there. And I think it's a great ending moment. Don't you? Like,
I do
kind of where they're supposed to be going. You
know? In my headcanon, he does become a success. He does go to London. He does get found. She hears her music on the radio. And she heals things with her husband and things get better. And that's, you know, like that. I hope they both go to live happy lives, rather than the story of he gets all emotionally fucked up by the girl again, doesn't have without Marquetta's help, he can't get his work out there. And she lives a horrible life with her abusive husband. That is not in my headcanon. That is not what I want to have happen to these people.
No, but I wonder if, because the end shot is her looking out the window, which I think is a great end shot because it's open to interpretation.
Yeah.
If she was happy with her life, she wouldn't look out the window. She would stay playing the piano, look at her kid, look at her husband, and keep playing the piano. But the fact she plays and looks out the window, she's thinking of him and his flight to London and where he's going. So will they hook up down the road? Who knows? But I like that it leaves it kind of open-ended and honors the relationship that we've been following through the whole movie, and leaves us with this glimmer of a possibility that they could hook up down the road and explore a relationship as he gets older, as you said, becomes more successful. Maybe he invites her to be a songwriter on an album like he did in real life, and they become a couple like they became in real life, and what have you. So I think it's a great ending for the movie. But again, even if they don't end up together, I think it's also important to remember there are people who come into your life for a certain season and change your life. And sometimes you never see them again, never hear from them again. Or you in time forget them, like their name or whatever. It happens. And so I think it's incredibly important.
Again, in my headcanon, these two never forget each other.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah, she will be with her great grandkids and think of playing Falling Slowly with him. The movie, obviously, for its size, was a big hit. It was, the budget was 114,000 euro, which is a very, very small budget. It went on to make over $20 million, which is just huge. It won the Independent Spirit Award for Best Foreign Film. And of course, they performed Falling Slowly on the Oscars, where it won the Academy Award.
Yeah, it beat out three songs from a Pixar movie, I think, or a Disney animation movie. It beat them out to win, which is unheard of, you know? And so I think that's amazing to see that happen for that that song. I mean, dude, that song is still a fucking banger, man. Just the honest emotion and the lyrics.
Yeah.
The real like pain in the lyrics, you know? And then, you know, we're today recording this episode, and last night we lost Hayden Panettiere at the young age of 36 years old. There are all kinds of stories popping up here from TMZ and other places that there was a possible overdose or cardiac arrest or a possible taking of her own life. And it's like songs like Falling Slowly, which speak about the pain of letting things go and that there's still time to put things back together, are so important, because people who suffer through mental health issues or addiction issues or pain issues or sexual assault issues or what have you, like in trying to repair their lives, songs like this allow them to express it, whether they're, you know, in the car with your wife at the time, Karen, or when you're by yourself, like he is at 3 a.m. on your bed, listening to this stuff. It allows your pain to come out through the words and through the lyrics. And I think that's why this song endures still 19 years after we heard it. It still feels like it came out yesterday or today even. And there's something magical about it. It's a timeless song in the way that like Cole Porter classics are timeless or Sinatra songs can be timeless. I think Falling Slowly is absolutely timeless in that way. Because I don't think Glenn ever made another song that came close to being as good as Falling Slowly. There's just something about this song that, in my opinion, is just the greatest thing he's ever created. You know,
I mean, he has a ton of great songs.
Yes, he does.
But this is like yesterday. You know what I mean? Like this is one of those songs for the ages. By the way, a well-known director went to see the film, and his response was, "A little movie called Once gave me enough inspiration to last the rest of the year." And that was Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
I mean, how would you feel to be a director and hear that Spielberg thought that about your little movie?
Again, art recognizing art, right? The artists rather recognizing art and being motivated by it. And I think that happens all the time. And Spielberg, who's always been one of these guys who's always seeking great movies and supports movies being in theaters and loves the idea of filmmaking, it's no surprise that he would be, you know, inspired by this movie. Because maybe it's, you know, kind of sparks something in him too to remember, like, you need that reminder that you're still an artist. You're still, no matter how successful you are, you create true art when you still think you're a busker on the street. You know, you're still fighting for it.
Yeah.
And so you have to be reminded of that all the time, because there's a purity in that. That's great.
I'll give my final thoughts first, which is, does this movie have beautiful cinematography? No. Does it have great production design? It's just the world. Does it use brilliant filmmaking or editorial techniques to tell this story? Not particularly. Does it have, you know, performances where someone morphs into an entirely different person? No, these people just feel like they're honestly being who they are. Does this capture some essence of what it means to create art and what it feels like to make an artistic connection? And does it have some sort of emotional valence that is coming from some deep place of truth? Yeah. And I'm there for it, you know? Like, I'm there to watch them make music together, to listen to him sing, and to just see these people that have this one beautiful, magical moment that is fleeting.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the greatest moments are fleeting, right? And Yeah, I love this movie, and falling back in love with it again was amazing. Because I've gotten older, I've become more cynical about the film world, about art, about artists. Influenced by seeing some of them become influencers and warping the art, using the art to promote other things. You know, these kinds of things that to frustrate you. So it's nice to like strip some of that away and remember what it's like to see the purity of a pursuit of an artist who is struggling with a relationship that may or may not be happening, a broken love, figuring out his voice, and her as well as a counter artist who is also like figuring out how to put her life back together and find some joy and satisfaction in her life within what she's going through. And there's a purity here that I think we sometimes can lose in movies. And the reason I began this conversation saying I wonder if it would be a hit today because, I mean, Power Ballad came out and nobody went to see it. And yeah. There are so many small movies that come out that are joys that people rarely go see nowadays because they just wait for it to come on streaming and they get so lost. So there's something really amazing about this little film that could in 2007 that still feels just as authentic now, 19 years later, as it did back then. And maybe I'll add what I said about the song Falling Slowly to the movie. This movie is timeless. It captures an artist at a certain time, two artists at a certain time, as you said, Steve, experiencing each other for a brief amount of time, but changing each other's lives. And so I think there's something powerful in that that we hold on to when we rewatch this movie. And as I said earlier, the authenticity of Glenn's performance, the awkwardness, the things he does with his face, all the emotions he goes through, they feel so real because they feel raw and probably reflecting where he was at the time. And then Marquita as well, a sweetness and a rawness and an honesty there, that there's something just really great about these characters as they come together and you cheer for them by the end of the movie in where they're going, their respective journeys. And John Carney, I think, does a wonderful job directing this movie with the lightest of touches. And it allows us to really kind of love it for what it is, you know?
So that's what we think of Once. Of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can visit us on Facebook, do a search for The Cinephiles, Cine_Files on X, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And if you want to subscribe to the show, you could do so at Apple Podcasts, where if you join the subscription level, you could be listening to these one takes 1 week in advance. You can also do so on patreon.com/thecinephiles. There are Cinephiles shorts. There's our advisory board. There are ad-free versions of the show. There are all sorts of ways that we give back to you if you help us make this show. And if you want to reach me, I am on SR Morris on Twitter. John, how would people reach you?
At The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all the social medias there. And of course, my YouTube channel, youtube.com/John Roca Says, where all the things are happening that Hot Mike, Hot Mike, the Geek Buddies, Spill the Tequila, and my reactions and reviews.
And I think that's it for this week. We'll be back probably in a couple weeks with another Cinephiles One Take.